And welcome to the Diablo podcast, your home for Diablo diehards, tryhards, casual, and hardcore alike. I am your host, Xanth, and I'm joined by my triumvirate of co-hosts, Nineball.
Oh, hi.
Nerdwords.
Hello.
And a special guest today, in fact, the focus of the podcast today, Mr. Harrison Ping.
Hello.
Now, Harrison, you get the floor here.
Oh, geez.
Who are you? And why would we bring you onto this Diablo-focused podcast?
I've been asking myself that all day. I am Harrison Pink. I was a senior quest designer on Diablo 4. I was pretty much there from almost the beginning, not from the exact beginning of the project. So about 6.5 years I worked on Diablo 4, which is not a small amount of time. So I sort of seen it through all of its incarnations. I worked on the campaign. I was in the story room for part of it. I worked on a ton of side quests. I did a lot of world building in Dry Steps and Hauazar, so I had my fingers in a lot of the pies across Diablo 4, mostly on like the narrative and sort of like environmental storytelling sides. So I've been doing that for a long time, and it sounds like you guys want to sort of hear about that maybe a little bit.
Absolutely. Now, before we do that, I'm going to put these lore nerds on pause. Let's talk a little bit about your history. So
sure.
Where are you currently? Mm-hmm. Just out of curiosity.
I'm currently the lead game designer at Cyan. Cyan is the company, if you know, the games Myst and Riven, and a couple of the more recent games, Abduction, Firmament. It's a sort of adventure game studio that's been around for a long, long time, since the 80s, actually. So it's a quite a storied place. And actually, Riven is one of the games that made me want to go into game development when I was a young lad, so it's kind of a dream to get to be a part of that team. It's very different from working at a 500 some odd size team on Diablo to like a 30 person studio, but it's been a really great time. It's been a dream.
I did some prior research, and I did find an article you wrote in 2015 in which you said, "I decided to major in 3D animation with hopes of one day working at Cyan."
I did it. I go back in time and tell myself that I did it.
That's pretty huge. I think, like, as I was going through and I was pulling things for the podcast here today, I think it's so cool to see that back in the day you had this goal, and we're going to talk a lot about the things that kind of fall in between it, but here you are and you have achieved exactly what you had set out to do so long ago, and that's awesome. That's
yeah,
awesome for
it
you.
Feels really good. Thank you very much. Yeah, it feels really good. It's been an incredible time. And I think that deep down, I love telling stories no matter what type of game it's in. Like, I've worked on Mafia 3, which was a large open world game, much more sort of action focused. I worked at Telltale Games, which was very, like, the mechanics were just the story effectively. So I've always worked in different mediums and games, but I've always been a person who prioritizes the kind of like story experience for the player. And so I've always like dug into the lore of, I worked on Tales from the Borderlands, and I became like the Borderlands lore guy at Telltale. So whatever it is, I love to sort of like get into the backstory and figure out what made the world tick and what all the sort of like legacy stuff that the other games have already established that would be fun to pull out and really kind of get my mind wrapped around the world and the characters and stuff. But I've always really enjoyed the storytelling aspect of video games.
We are very appreciative of the work that you have done. In fact,
thank you.
This weekend, and I'll share it with you too, I did, I stumbled across a 4-hour long video of the Diablo series. Video essayist who, off the top of my head, I am blanking on, basically chronicles the entirety of Diablo, providing, some pointed critiques along the way. One of the things that really stood out, as you get to the Diablo 4 section, 3 hours in,
right,
was the commentary around the story and how it is probably one of the best in the entire series. And a lot of that, I think, is courtesy of the work and the world building that you and the team did to really make it feel fleshed out. So I was pulling quotes again, like I said, meticulously researching. And I liked this one. I thought this was a good framing for what we can talk about today. In 2014, you wrote about themes versus mechanics. And you said themes versus mechanics is fallacious. I believe it's missing an incredibly important third piece that changes the relationship between the two. And that is feeling. So Harrison, as we're talking about that, how do you think feeling was incorporated into Diablo 4?
Great question. I can't take really much credit at all for the main campaign, other than sort of being one of the small cogs in the machine. When the creative director joined the team, he had a very specific vision about what he wanted to, the story that he wanted to tell, the very character-centric, very grounded story about the people in Sanctuary that he wanted to tell. And I was lucky enough to be in some of the story meetings to help sort of like break down how that sort of story that he wanted to tell could be told through the medium of quests. Using the verbs that we have in Diablo 4, like there's only so many things you can get the player to do in Diablo 4, so trying to figure out how to like establish this sort of beats that he wanted to tell in this story. He actually wrote almost like a prose story. He actually wrote it like beginning to end with the characters, and then we had to sort of sit down and break that down into quests and arcs, and from there like specific objectives, and make sure they all kind of felt different but cohesive. So I can't, I can't, and it was a big team. Like we had a lot of really talented quest designers doing that. It wasn't just myself. So I can only speak on that on a sort of like a very shallow level. But when it comes to, I'm happy to speak on side quests, which I obviously had a lot more control over when I built those side quests. And one of the things that's really important for me is, as I said in that talk a long time ago, is making sure that the player comes away with a specific feeling that you want them to have through a combination of the story you're trying to tell and the mechanics that you have at your disposal. And depending on how much mechanic versus like story you have room for, you can kind of get close. Like I don't think there's ever any quest that I made where I'm like, I did it. I nailed the feeling 100%. Every human being that plays this is going to feel the exact way that I want them to feel. But you can get as close as you possibly can. Like you can throw the dart and generally hit the target close enough. And there's no way to get a player to feel a feeling. You can sort of help them towards a goal, but everyone's always going to have a different interpretation of the game that they've played, the story that they've experienced, and obviously it goes through the filter of your own experiences as a human being, and like the biases that you have in your brain about interpreting the things that you're seeing and what's going on and what the meaning is. So there's no way to like force a player to feel a certain way. And I think I did actually talk about this in that specific talk. I'm like, you can't make people care about characters. You can't just be like, you will care about this character because I write in the story that you care. You have to sort of encourage them to care and like give them opportunities to find things to care about in the characters. But it's not, there's no guarantee. There's a lot of people who play the quests and they're just like, boring, don't care, skip. And we know a lot of people hit space bar a lot. It's heartbreaking, but we accept that, right? So when it comes to feeling in a game like Diablo 4, it's tough. It's a balance, right? Because you want to make sure that you're not getting in the way of the gameplay. Like the core gameplay loop of Diablo 4 is very fast. It's an extremely fast-paced game. And so to be like, all right, I'm going to make you sit through like 1,000 pages of dialogue between these two characters back and forth to get this really deep story about like a girl and her mother. People are like, I just want to go kill demons. Please just get out of the way so I can kill some demons. So really trying to find a way to have the story be there if you want it. But not sort of like force you into interacting with it, to sort of allow players to explore at their own leisure is a real challenge. I don't know if that answers your question, but it's a difficult and challenging one in a game like Diablo 4 specifically.
You think there's a quest that stands out that you think does evoke that is able to get feeling across as well? I remember a long time ago, like around release, you had put out a great Twitter thread going through that introductory quest as you're choosing which thing to burn and like the what you write on it. I mean, like I feel like that is rather evocative. There are other side quests off the top of my head, but I don't know what your involvement was. If so, I don't want to bring up, the Flayed Man in the Fractured Peaks if you weren't involved in that one.
I did not get involved in that, but it's an excellent quest. It comes up a lot actually in terms of when we talk to newer quest designers, like junior quest designers, in terms of you can make a really incredible, memorable quest that's like 2 minutes. You can make a quest that everyone remembers, and it's always on like top Diablo quest lists. Everyone loves the Flayed Man Cenobite quest, right? And we point to that and be like, you don't have to write like a 15-hour like Final Fantasy VII magnum opus story to get something that's really memorable and really fun that people love. Look, you can do like one cool thing, or you run in, see a crazy thing, kill a demon, and the quest ends, and you can still have a really, really compelling quest. So I didn't work on that quest, but it does come up a lot in terms of really explaining like, hey, you've got to lean into the medium. You have to lean into the fact that the game is going to be a certain way. You can't like pretzel the game into being a different game because you want it to be a long form storytelling game, like let's say like The Witcher or Baldur's Gate, right? Like we can't really do what Baldur's Gate can do, and if we try, we just make a crappy Baldur's Gate and a crappy Diablo. We can't make a good version of that in the game that we have. So that does come up a lot in that example. But to actually answer your question, I worked heavily on the prologue. We had like what we call a strike team, which is a sort of a multidisciplinary team of people that get together and really sort of like hone in on the exact experience you want. So in the strike team for the prologue, we had, interactive designers, we had animators, we had combat encounter designers to work on the boss fights and stuff. We had story people, we had, VFX, we had like a whole little pod of experts to really like dial in everything. And it's funny that you bring up the prologue, because the prologue is like the slowest part of the game by far. It's really slow. You get to kill like three wolves in like 5 minutes. There's a lot of dialogue. It's slow, but like we did that intentionally because, as you said, like we want to. It's your first Diablo 4 experience. You've been waiting forever to play this game. We want it to be really, really clear what the tone of this game is, what the mood of this game is. Like we really want to say this is not Diablo 3. This is not like super hyperspeed game right out of the gate, right? And we had a lot of not pushback. We had a lot of people that were like not so sure about this across the team at the beginning, because they hadn't seen it. We were just expressing the vision. They're like, "Yeah, but I just want to kill a bunch of demons, you know?" And you're like, "I promise you, once it's in and you're playing it, you'll see it. You'll get it. You'll get the feeling we're going for, which is like you're scared. You're level one. You have like a basic attack to swing your wand at like wolves, and wolves jump out from behind you and attack you, and it's kind of scary." Getting like horror or like scary stuff into Diablo, like Diablo 1, everyone always was like, "Oh, the butcher scared me a lot when I was a kid." And it's like in D1, everyone remembers the butcher running at you yelling fresh meat, and you're terrified because you're gonna die. But it's really hard in contemporary Diablo games, which is just kind of a power fantasy game, to find places for horror feelings. So the prologue was really the only opportunity that we really had to sort of like hem the player into sort of like not feeling powerful for a while. Like we're like, "Okay, we're gonna put a wolf here and a wolf here." Like we were specifically placing wolves. We had skeletons in specific places to ambush you. And each one also at for the prologue had to teach you a game mechanic, right? So like we put ranged skeletons in front of the dungeon entrance so that you'll probably get hit by an arrow and you'll probably lose life, and we can teach you how the potion system works. So it has to like pull like triple duty of like setting the tone, getting you to know what the story is, and also telling you like how to play the freaking game. It's tough. It's really tough and a really complicated, very like crunchy game like Diablo to have room for just tone when it's like, "How do I open the menu and like equip my boots?" So it's really tough to get that to really prioritize feeling. So you kind of find spaces for it when you can, you know.
One of the things I also really enjoyed about the prologue that you mentioned, like the pacing of it being like really slow, because that is also just one of the most impactful kind of like scenes that you have, that like kind of like invokes a feeling. Once you're done with the dungeon and everything, you go back to town where you know something is wrong. Like as you go through and you're drinking in the bar, is like, this really is a setup to a horror movie, isn't it? Then of course, then you get thrown onto the cart. It takes ages,
So
ages to get pulled
long.
into the cabin.
So long, yeah.
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 I don't know what you can speak to or anything like that, but I know that there was one version of the game that actually had you walk by that warehouse, like the cabin that you're pulled into on your way to the dungeon, but then the layout of the zone and everything like that was changed. And I felt like when going through and playing through that version, when you walk past it and it's like there's no way to get in there, something bad is going to happen in that place. I specifically like remember that as part of like the feedback and some of like the early testing. Was that I really liked that feeling, and I was sad that when like guess the topography was changed and you no longer were introduced, you just zoom right by it. You don't have that feeling of ominous, what's in the shed, like.
I agree completely. And it's just one of those unfortunate things of like, okay, well, we had to do certain things for the story. So for example, you wake up in the barn and you're killing a bunch of the villagers, which is horrifying, right? Like it's not supposed to be a power fantasy. You're like killing people with like names, and like I bought stuff from that person. Like it's horrible, right? But then you originally all the combat took place in the barn and the door was locked, and the key you got opened the barn doors, and then you and Yosef would like walk out and he'd tell you about what he'd seen and all that stuff. But we wanted to have that combat beat be a little bit more substantial. So that's why you can open the doors and do combat in the open area, sort of like outside the front of the barn. What's her name? Vani? Yeah. Vanrell? Vani, the woman who gives you the quest, she stands there with the bow and arrow to like shoot you, and she can't move because she has to like die to become a corpse. She can flip over to get the key, right? So like it's like a list of like conditions and like dependencies. Like, well, we can't let you leave the area because you could kite them all the way down to a really weird place, and then they would die and the key wouldn't appear. You could get into a bad state gameplay wise. So, but you do want to have more combat outside the front of the barn. So I guess we have to put up like a wall. And the door can't be opened. You can't leave that until Yosef like opens the doors for you to like go back into the zone. So it was a loss on like, you can't really see the barn because of that big fence. But because of the other story stuff we wanted to do to make the combat feel a little bit more beefy and for having more combat outside of the barn, we had to sort of like make that trade off.
Amazing.
And we all learned something today.
Yep.
Games are hard to make is the answer. Right.
Oh, I thought you just like threw it. You just typed some code and then it worked. And stuff
you hit
like
the make
that.
Game button. And that's why all game devs are lazy. Because you just have a make game button you should just hit.
There's a book, right? You just copy from the book.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's page. Well, I mean, like, I mean, the prologue changed so many times because we knew it was like our introduction to the game that everyone's been waiting for so long, and it was going to feel very different. And you know, we must have made the prologue, I mean, I must have remade the prologue 30-40 times. You know, we all worked, and not just me, everybody, we all worked on a bunch of different versions. We always started in the cave, you always walked into the town. The early versions, like the door was like frozen, you had to like break the door down. People were like, well, that's your first encounter with a door in Diablo, maybe you'll think all the doors are breakable. Like, we had like a lot of just like back and forth discussions about like, if you're a Diablo purist, you probably know, I know doors, how doors work. But if you've never played a Diablo game, it's your first Diablo game. So we had to make a lot of decisions on it's onboarding new players, it's onboarding pre-existing like Diablo fans. What are the expectations that you have coming into a Diablo game? So it's the opening of the game and the ending of the game are like the absolute hardest things to really nail. And I'm sure other developers would probably agree that like the first part, like 20 minutes of the first chunk of the game is like the thing you finish last, right? Because you don't know what the game's going to be until you get to the end. And then you take all those learnings back to the opening experience, and then you can kind of polish it up from there.
Kind of like writing a paper. I'm an English teacher. I tell my students the exact same thing, that you start with your thesis, you know what you're going to try and prove, and then you do the body paragraphs, and then come back to your introduction because you don't know what you're introducing because you haven't written it yet. I think that's a cool perspective to have. Let's pause at the prologue because I think there's a beautiful segue in there, in building up to what will be a return to Diablo. What was your Diablo experience? You know, growing up, what was your experience playing Diablo?
What was your Diablo prologue?
And also, it similarly started in a frozen, cold, snowy waste of Ontario, Canada. I didn't play Diablo 1. I grew up in Bermuda, which is a very small island off the eastern coast of America, and it's a British colony. It's like 20 miles wide. It's super small. It's like living in a very small town that you can't leave. And it was a great way to grow up. It was a really fun place to play, you know, adventure games and get lost and go in a rowboat and go to some other island. Like, it was a really fun way to grow up, so I have no regrets about it. But getting things like comic books, video games, like video game magazines, it would just be whatever came in on the container because everything is shipped in, right? So you were like, you want the next issue of GamePro? Good luck. Like, if you see a thing you want, it might not get it, might not show up. And same thing with comic books, which is why it took me a long time to get into comics, because like, if you're waiting for like Wolverine number 7, you're like, you might never get that one. And with video games. So I had a very small selection of video games growing up. So I didn't have Diablo 1. I never played Diablo 1. And I went away to boarding school in Ontario, Canada. And for the first time, I had like the access to every video game in like North America, like stores. And all my friends at boarding school were like, Diablo 2 is coming out. Like, we're all picking it up. We're all going to play together Diablo 2. Like, you got to play this game. And I was like, okay, I don't know. Everyone's playing it. I don't know what it is, but I'll just buy it. Everyone else seems to want to play it. And I installed it, and I just go, and it's like 3 years later, I've just been doing nothing but playing the game. And so my first character was a necromancer named Tiramisu, And all of my characters, every single Diablo character is always named after food since then. I don't know what it is. I don't know why. It's just been like everyone has like their thing, right? So I guess I've always named my Diablo characters after food. I don't know why. But yeah, and I think I went full minion build because I was lazy and I didn't know how to play the game. So I'm like, y'all can play the skeleton play for me. And so I've always been a Necro Summoner main, no question. And then we played multiplayer and we played, you know, did all the PvP. And I don't think we ever really got into like the deep, deep end game. Cause I think as being a story guy, I'm like, well, the story's finished. So I'll play with my friends to help them grind up and stuff. But I never really like went hard on like, you know, Malphiel run, not Malphiel, you know, Meph runs or anything like, you know, Dariel runs for stuff. But, I played a lot of that game, mostly just doing the story over and over again and seeing what new stuff I could discover. But that got me through boarding school, so that was a thank you, big thank you to Blizzard North for that game.
And then any Diablo 3 prior to Diablo
4? Oh, absolutely. Yeah, a ton. Gosh, I was at Telltale. I must have been at Telltale 2012, so I was at Telltale when that game came out. And I remember, like, buying it immediately, and it was way too hard. And the loot was really hard to get, and like it was the auction house was still around. But at that point, I don't think I had any friends that were playing Diablo at the time, so I just soloed the whole thing, soloed the whole experience. And I remember getting to like Act 3 or like late in Act 3, and it was just so hard that I had to just like do the thing where you just grind a bunch to get levels. And I'm so bad at grinding, I get really bored when I'm like, I just want to do more story stuff. I'm not interested in just like killing the same demon over and over again. So I put it down until they did the big patch that like made like the loot easier. They kind of like turned the auction house off and like they all the torment stuff, they like, fixed all that stuff, you know. Then I went back and I plowed through that game. I can't remember. I think Witch Doctor was my first class. Again, because it was like the Necromancer, the closest like analogy to the Necromancer. So I think I played Witch Doctor main, and then I think that a Wizard, and I played it again. And then, you know, Reaper came out, and I think a lot of my friends were playing when Reaper came out. So I remember doing like the campaign multiplayer in Reaper, and it was like a totally different game. Like the vibes were totally different, and it was like really good. I think probably played more Diablo 2 than I did Diablo 3, mostly because I was like an adult who had obligations at that point in my life, but it was not a comment on like I didn't like Diablo 3. I definitely put several hundred hours into that game for sure.
So, you know, you've bounced from, you know, playing Diablo 2, playing Diablo 3, and then you get to work on Diablo 4, and you, there's decades in between each of these games. Is there a pressure that comes with that?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I've almost always worked on sequels. Not always. I mean, Telltale's Walking Dead wasn't a sequel, but it was based on an existing IP with a lot of fans. So, and I was at that point a big lore nerd. Like, I'd read all the books. I'd read, you know, all of the novels, the mainline Sin War novels and stuff, and the Book of Cain or whichever was out at that point. So I was like really deep on the lore, and I felt pretty confident that I kind of generally got what they were going for. And so I joined the team. And we were at that, it was so early days, right? Like I remember we were just working in Skosglen. Like Skosglen, they had decided was like the zone we were going to like mess around with first. And so we were just trying to figure out like, what does a quest look like in Diablo 4? What's the main game loop? What are the different systems that are going to work together? Like, what are we taking from Diablo 3? What are we taking from Diablo 2 or Diablo 1? Like, what's the vibe? And so I honestly, I didn't think about like, the like, oh my God, I'm going to screw the legacy up. I got to make sure I don't screw this up. I wouldn't say that I was like overconfident or like confident, like, I got this. I'm not worried. But I remember just feeling really supported by the team. Like everyone around me, we're all like, even now, like the Diablo team is filled with extremely passionate people who love Diablo so much. There was never a moment where I was like, I'm out here alone. Like I'm just floating out here. If I screw this up, it's going to be my fault, you know? So, I felt that just the pressure of being at Blizzard in general, like I finally did it. I made it to Blizzard. Like this is like, I'm really proud of myself for making it to such an like illustrious company, making these games that I love. I played many hours of World of Warcraft, you know? So I was so happy to be at Blizzard. I didn't want to screw that up. But I was just surrounded by such kind and incredibly talented people that I was just excited to learn from all the time. And the first few months was almost like summer camp where I was just like, just surrounded by incredibly talented, smart people all the time. And I just got to like learn the tools and just like come up with cool stories that I know weren't really going to make it into the final product, but just like stretching my legs. And so I was more focused on that at that time than like, if I probably stopped to think for long enough, it would have been like, oh no, we got to make sure we don't screw this one up. But, you know, I had a lot of faith in the leadership, and they seemed to sort of like know exactly what direction they wanted to go. So like, that took a lot of the pressure off me.
And it seems to have been a pretty good success.
Depends on who you ask, but I think so. I'm really happy. I'm really proud of the game that we shipped, for sure.
I think
it is objectively successful. Like, there's no, that's true. There's, like, it is objectively like all the neckbeards can get over it, because like, no matter what beefs you may have with any system here or there, speaking from someone who's played since Diablo 1, since 1994, like I grew up with it. Like, I've always played 96. Diablo, and the first one was 96. Yeah, it was 96. Yeah. Never mind. Anyways, I was playing
Fall. Stop talking.
But the point is, though, is that like, you talk about intentionality in the questing and the prologue and how much you guys iterated on that and went through it. And that more than any Diablo game, despite what anyone says, that intentionality is throughout all of Diablo 4, especially in the campaign and all the side quests. And me and Nine have talked about it quite a lot about how the side quests are really the unsung hero of Diablo 4 for us lore nerds, right? They're there for us to go, you know what, you guys have fun with your grinding loop, and I love that stuff too. I am a grinder as well, but I love the side quests in this game. So to hear that intentionality, like, it really, like, I think it captured that. It did for me, for sure. I know it did for most of us. So objectively successful, yeah.
I appreciate that. I appreciate that. I like I said, I'm really happy with, you know, there's no such thing as a perfect game. Ultimately, you run out of time, always. Every game I've ever worked on is like a sprint to the finish. There was never a point when we were like, it's perfect. Like, we nailed it. Like, we know, I think everybody kind of knew that, like, yeah, we if we could get more time, it'd be great. But like, it's been 6.5 years. It's been a long time on this game. I was like, please, like, we can continue to iterate on it. It's a live game. Like, we can continue to make it better. But I think all the feedback and all the things people feel about it are totally valid. Like, I'm not here to say like it's how you feel is incorrect in any way. But I am proud of the part that I played in it, for sure.
And I think you absolutely should be. Like, you're absolutely right. There, no matter what, a game will be criticized in some capacity. I do think that the general universal acclaim, like, the criticism wasn't on story.
Yeah, no.
Yeah.
Like, the story for Diablo 4 has been amazing. And the fact that even just the little bits that we get on each season cause more questions to come up and create more conversation is a testament to the world building that happened within the story. Because it's not just a, you know, like, hey, this other random NPC showed up again. That's our season theme. No, right. There's like little layers that get to build off of the story, which is exciting. Now, granted, I'm sure Nineball and Nerdwords have more in-depth questions around that.
I could go forever. Yes. Let's go. Well, okay. So I guess the one question I'm really thinking about here, especially with you talking about intentionality, and again, like, I come back to that a lot because that's really important, you know, like, especially for a franchise that's been around as long as it is, you have to take very great care with what exists already. But obviously, to tell your story and to, you know, go down avenues you want to go down, there might be some things that need to change. And so I guess, like, I don't know what your level of involvement with this part of the questing was, but there was two quests specifically, or two chains of side quests specifically. I don't know their names off the top of my head, but I do know that, like, they tied up loose ends in other Diablo games. Was there intentionality there to do that, or did they kind of like get born out of the process of creating the quest? And like, you know what, we could really tell the story of the Diablo 2 Paladin and what happened to him and finally tie up that loose end here, or the Crusader story as well, right? Like, both were very cool and amazing little surprises that if you don't go off the beaten path, you're not going to find it. And I love that, because I remember like messaging Nineball feverishly, like in the middle of the night, be like, dude, did you see this thing? And he, you know, of course he had already seen it, but yeah. So yeah,
I did it for you guys. It's just Thank you. I was the zone supervisor of Hawazar. So obviously we had other talented. I didn't work on the Crusader. I didn't work on either of the two quests, but I knew that I basically put a thumbprint down. I'm like, we're doing. This is the place to do that stuff. Nice. So it was other really, really talented quest designers on the team that actually did it, but I was sort of the point person. So I was, to keep it really short, the zone supervisor sort of, I think you can think of it like the deputy creative director, where like I take the creative director's vision and I'm sort of just like evangelizing it to the team and making sure everyone sort of like understands, like, this is what Hawazar is about. Here are the theory, like the themes narratively, here's the factions, here's the towns, here's the, each sort of like what we call subzones, I think are called regions in the game. Like, here's the themes for each of them. Like, they need to feel really distinct so that you, when you're doing a quest near Backwater, it feels different than the quests at Zarbinzett, right? But we basically make the box and then let the quest designers pitch quests. But a handful of them, like, we're doing Linden's backstory, no question, that's happening. We're doing a Johanna related thing. It's not the Johanna from past games, but it's maybe a Johanna from maybe there's a relation. There's some kind of hook there.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because that was like one of my things, is like when they go through and they were talking, it's like, oh, it's Johanna, you know, but then you get there, you get to the corpse, and it's like, wait, that's not Johanna.
Yeah,
you
got dark hair. We intentionally picked a corpse that had dark hair because we were like, well, it's not that Johanna.
Yeah.
But who knows? They all share the same name, right? So like getting out the lore, that quest did double duty, right? It was a little like wink to D3, but it was also some lore about like how crusaders work. Like the whole idea of the initiate taking on the mantle of the master, taking the name of the master, like that quest was kind of about that, and like teaching you about the lore of the crusaders on like a wider level.
It was honestly just like so well done, because like in the middle of the quest, as you're going through and talking to her, after as she like gets the art, you like you find the corpse, and then you have to go into the dungeon to find the armor itself, and when she puts on the armor, her name changes.
So
in the dialogue it becomes Johanna. It's like, so it's like, you know, just one of those, like,
so cool. You have no idea how hard that stuff is to do in our game, actually.
It's really difficult
to do that stuff. But yeah, that was exactly where, like, oh, like they have become that character, right? Specifically for Karthus, that was 100% me. I remember pitching the idea of the Black Tomb to the creative director. I'm like, well, we need a beat for Donan. This is the Donan side of the story. Donan has to like try and do something with the Soul Stone. It doesn't go well. What if he has to attune the Soul Stone to like Mephisto's essence, because Lilith and Mephisto are related, and that goes badly. Like he has to have a stumble and fail for the story, like the emotional arc that the creative director wanted to put him on. So I pitched, like, I don't know, what if, like, what could he attune it to? What if this is, we know that the crusaders came to the east, what if the crusader from D2 like took Sankikor's body, which is still like the Pope, right, and like hid it away, but it's like radioactive, it's got like Mephisto radiation coming off of it, so he like buries it in like a bomb shelter and just decides, okay, we're gonna stay here forever and guard it, and that's the end of the D2 paladin. Then that'd be a cool story to tell. And also like a tomb made out of onyx, rad and metal. So I pitched it, and they were like, cool, that sounds great. So we made the whole the keep. Also, you can't tell this, but the whole keep is off by 5 degrees or like 10 degrees. Like the whole thing is like slanted because it's sliding into the marsh. You can't tell from the camera angle, but cool. I had to take all the assets and like the waypoint and stuff and make them go like a little bit because they were like floating. But the whole keep and all the story around that, I really wanted to be about Karthus and the fall and all that stuff. But what happened was, it just ate all the air in the room from the Donan stuff. So we go into the tomb, and originally the skeleton in front of like the 40K door, like the sealed wax door, was going to be Karthus' skeleton, and he was going to drop a lore book, and he was going to tell you all. But like in that moment, that would have just totally been a complete tangent from the Donan stuff. And so the creative director's like, we don't have room for it. We don't have room for like two separate stories. So at that point I said, okay, totally fair. This is much like the grounded Donan failure story is way more important. But we got quest dollars to spend, and I want to make this, I think it's really important to get to talk about, like, people love it when we talk about the D2 canonical D2 characters, and the Paladin's one that we haven't talked about, and it's the Crusaders, and it's like all this other stuff just lined up perfectly. So I worked with another quest designer and sort of like walked him through, like, I would really like to do a Karthus quest where you learn about that guy. And you know what's actually, here's a secret tidbit. The Karthus corpse in the dungeon, he was wearing like the Paladin armor from like the start screen of D2. He's got the shield, right? The heater shield. That corpse is actually from D2R. That we had an artist actually was able to pull the asset of the armor and like swap him out and put a skeleton in, like kind of like up-res it and make it look like it's from Diablo 4 and just like pose him on the ground. So that asset we literally got because the other team had been working on Diablo 2 Resurrected, and we didn't. He just like, what if I just grab that and pose it for you on the ground? And we're like, amazing. And then later on, I think in patch one or season one or season two, we were actually able to get the heater shield. You can actually do a really short follow-up quest to actually get a transmog that's like the actual heater shield from the from the opening of the game, which only Necros can use, weirdly, but hey, it's in the game now. So it's a long story short, but like, I really thought it was important in the area where I could pull off those like lore pieces and not eat the space reserved for the campaign in side quests. Like, that's the point of side quests, is not to tell a bunch of kind of random fun little OC where I make my OC character up and like do some fun stories. It's like, we're really here to support the world building that the campaign is doing and support the world building that like that's already there. Like, I went into Hawazar knowing that the D3 Crusaders probably came here because they says they went to the east and this is the most eastern part of the world. So that was like a legacy piece that we brought forward, and we're like, what already exists in the world that we should probably pay off here? So that's why the Crusaders are like bummed out, like war-torn soldiers in Zarbenzet, because like the lore kind of assumed they were generally probably in this region. And then it kind of spun out from there, like, oh, this clearly was originally part of the Kijan Empire, like when the borders were wider, like it all just sort of like made sense. So it's really important to side quests and not just be sort of like frivolous. You don't want to waste those dollars. You want to really spend them to prop up the rest of what the game is doing, you know?
And it's like, for, you know, like a lore fan like myself, it's that interconnectivity, you know, showing that, you know, like there's a clear timeline. There's events and characters that continue to overlap and have impacts that kind of like span throughout the ages, or, you know, at least until like the next title, you know,
right.
You can have like those little touches. And it's something that even is just like kind of like in the DNA of Diablo, because it was in Diablo 2, like one of the biggest like things was the fan theories and such of, you know, Blood Raven, the summoner, you know, and of course, the Dark Wanderer himself was like, you know, we got the canon story of that. It was the warrior became the dark wanderer, mm-hmm. but whatever happened to the rogue, you know, and the sorcerer, and we got payoffs on those stories and such. So it's cool to see that continue through, you know, multiple titles.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, you know, as I'm sure, you know, like the D4 story is very sort of separate from the timeline, other than like the Inarius and the Lilith stuff. And like the story is kind of not really, there's not a lot of connective tissue to D3 or the previous games, because the creative director really had a very specific vision about the story he wanted to tell about the Haradrim and about your character and about Nayrel and all these characters, and really wanted to ground it in individual characters. So really trying to find ways to tie back into the larger sort of like Diablo franchise like story that's happening around was really important to a lot of people, not just to me, to make sure we didn't feel like we're telling like a weird little bottle story, like a bottle episode. We wanted to feel like, no, these are events that have been like in the making since like D1, D2, D3, you know?
Building on that, if you don't mind me continuing the questions, like one of the big things that I had a question when you're talking about that, like, where it's kind of like its own little story, is specifically like the use of Lilith and Inarius. Like, obviously with the intro cinematic, we have an understanding of how Lilith got back, but I always felt that Inarius's return was always kind of like a little hand wavy. It's just, oh yeah, no, he's been back.
He's just back. Yeah.
Like if you know the lore, you kind of understand, well, I guess Mephisto and all those other people that would actually be watching over his, you know, prison are all dead or gone and such. But we never like kind of like got that confirmation of how did he get out, you know?
Right. Yeah, it's an interesting one because a lot of people are like, it's a plot hole. You're like, that's not what a plot hole is. It's definitely lore that we left intentionally vague, and the game hints at it pretty strongly through like optional stuff. You can like read lore books, and you can read like see the paintings and stuff about like his but the idea was that we don't know the true story, because all we have is a propaganda from the Cathedral of Light, and that's kind of the more important thing to get out to the player. It's like, they only have the story that Inarius tells about how fucking rad he is and how great he is and how cool he just like kicked all the demons in the balls and like shot back out of hell, you know? Like, he has a very specific story that he wants to tell, and the fact that nobody knows the truth, it was actually an intentional choice for the story. I don't disagree with you, but no. The other thing that's really important to remember is like there are lots of other ways for stories from the Diablo universe to come out. You know, like there's mm-hmm. there's books, there's all sorts of different things that the team, if they chose to do to investigate that story further, we could do. My headcanon was like my own personal headcanon was just that when the Black Soulstone was destroyed, all of the like, you know, all of the it sort of like just like shook things up, and like there was lots of like crazy power struggles and stuff in hell, and he was able to sort of like slip away because there was nobody watching him, like you said. And yeah. I will say, really, 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 like, pre this creative director joining the team's story, we actually did go and, like, see him chained up when we actually rescued him. But that, again, like, was a very, very different story. That was way more like Diablo 3, like, very high fantasy, very, like, big, high concept sort of story about the big, like, war between the forces. And we just lost all the humanity in it. And it was, like, the main characters weren't, like, Loreth and Donan, it was, like, Anarius. And it just didn't feel, I think, the way that the creative director wanted it to feel, which was like, it's about the people. So I totally hear the feedback, and I've heard it a lot from a lot of people, and you're not wrong at all about it. So whether or not you agree with this being the correct choice, but it was absolutely not, like, it was like an oversight. We kind of chose to say, like, this is kind of a thing nobody really knows the truth of.
And it's something that is kind of communicated in the game. I remember we were having discussions in earlier episodes of the podcast, once the game itself came out, how, the scrawlings, you know, in the necropolis that, you know, that Nerol's mother is going through and putting down of Lilith's version of the story are very different from the paintings in Anarius's sanctum. That is, like, they're both telling completely different stories, you know, of how they got to this point. So,
I mean, I love Anarius is one of my favorite characters. His fatal flaw is he just doesn't learn a lesson ever, right? Like, he never changes. He, like, Lilith changes and adapts. Like, she failed with Odysseon. She, like, tries different things. She's, like, adaptable and she's clever. And Anarius is so freaking stupid. He just comes back, establishes the same church, does the exact same thing. Like, he just literally starts the same church up again, which I think is flavor text that I put on the one of the unique items, where he's like, yeah, he just came back and started the same church again. That was step one for his plan to get back to heaven. And I think that it's fun that, like, that's his fatal flaw. Like, that's his, like, his Shakespearean flaw, is that he just never learns a lesson. And so it's great.
Yeah, that's like going back to, like, Diablo 1 of, you know, like, his story in the manual. It's like he's always been, like, the archangel of vanity.
Yeah, yeah, you know? That's good. I like that. I mean, like, we've seen that angel characters can evolve, right? Like, Tyriel obviously evolved a lot, and Malthiel obviously evolved a lot in a different direction. So it's not like there's always these stoic, like, unchanging beings, but I like the, and he's also kind of a nobody. He's not in the Angiris Council. He's just a random soldier. He's like a lieutenant. He's just a guy,
dude. Yep.
who happened to get his hands on the Worldstone. So I love that he's not like an important character in, like, the cosmology, other than getting his hands on the Worldstone and creating Sanctuary. Like, he's kind of just a footnote soldier. And I think that's, I love it when it's not, it's just some random character. I love when it's much more lower to the earth, you know.
Well, and I mean, I'm just going to throw this out there, too. He never learns his lesson, but I mean, just like the player characters, we also worship Mommy Lilith, so I get it completely. I mean, let's be honest, right? No, so
I was always Team Daddy. I'm just.
I'm never Team Daddy. I'm not. If I had the robe, I would keep it and I would love it, but I would never wear it because I'm not an Anarius fanboy. But
he sucks. I mean, he sucks. Let's just be honest. He sucks.
Yeah, he does. I mean, honestly, all of the angels suck. Most part, at least the demons want to use us. They don't want to just murder us all, even though they do it more than anybody else. But the angels wanted us gone, except for Tyriel. But anyways, I have a question, actually. And I don't know if you can go into this, because this is a part, because that's the tricky part, is that some of this ties into, like, the main narrative and the main story as well, too. But I know you did have, you know, you said you sat in on some of that stuff, too. So I am curious. Because you brought up some things that have sparked a lot of questions, and one I'm going to save for the very end. But the first one I have, so me and Nine have talked about this, and there's been a lot of speculation, because there's a lot of, like, vague nuance and, like, metaphor through a lot of different conversations and side quests and the main narrative. But is Haoazar actually a part of Sanctuary, or is it something else entirely? Because obviously the theory is that it's not.
I will say this before I answer this question. This is not a Blizzard canon official. Okay. I can't say that because A, I don't work there anymore, and B, like, the creative director might disagree with me. So this is just me, Harrison, saying this. Haoazar is absolutely part of Sanctuary. Like, you take your horse and you drive your horse from Khajistan across a bridge, and you're in Haoazar. I believe it's supposed to be a bit more metaphorical about the idea behind the Tree of Whispers, as from my understanding, being in story meetings with the creative director and with folks, is that it is sort of a neutral middle party, like a third party that does not really give a shit about heaven or hell. It's like older and weirder, and the intention behind this, especially with, like, the giant snake and stuff, is that, like, there's weird shit just in Sanctuary that has nothing to do with the heavens and the hells. It's just like sometimes weird, horrible deities and weird creatures just like appear and just like manifest themselves, and they're unknowable and weird in that kind of like Cthulhu way. Because what we don't want is that, like, if you just draw a line down the center and you have like good, like Team Blue and Team Red, everything in the game falls on one of those two. And so, and I think that the creative director really felt, he had a really specific like Gnostic philosophy he wanted to pull from, in terms of like, there's other weird things and humans are kind of bad on their own sometimes, and there's no like right or wrong, and things are muddy and weird and unknowable. Because if it was just, as I said, Team Red and Team Blue, everything there is to know about those two factions. We've kind of told you everything there is to know. So to sort of inject more mystery back into the world, I think that was kind of the goal there, is to just be like, there's old weird powers at work that have nothing to do with the angels and demons, don't care about the angels and demons, have their own motives. The Tree of Whispers has its own motive that we have no idea about, sends witches out to do weird things across Sanctuary. It's got its own like agenda that it's trying to do, and we don't ever tell the player what that stuff is. It's actually, to pivot slightly really quickly, it was actually really important to us, to the quest team and sort of the writing, the narrative team, to find spaces to re-inject questions into the world, because it's really addictive to world build. It's fun to weave something out of nothing and be like, ah, this thing, it's this, here's what that is. It feels really good to do that, but eventually you fill in all the pieces of the puzzle, and you just look, you stand back and you can see the entirety of the puzzle. And there's just no questions left. There's no mystery left. And it's like turning the light on in the monster movie. You can just see the rubber suit. So for example, like the drowned monster family, again, this is just that ship, right? Like during base village shipping Diablo 4, we made a very intentional purpose, like choice to not tell you what the fuck they are. Like, what are they? Are they zombies? Are they creatures? Are they building shit underwater somewhere? Are they, I mean, they're clearly like corpses that wash up on the beach, but like, why are they coming back as them and not zombies? Is there someone controlling them? Is there like a weird faction leader? Like, we had a lot of internal conversations about what that is, and I think there's a lot of understanding of what that is internally, but we were like, we're never going to tell you what that is, at least at ship, because you just need a mystery. You need to not know what, because if you open a bestiary, like, here's what a goat man is, and it just like writes it all out, it just becomes like a fact, and it's not like a fairy tale anymore, right? And it robs some of the sort of magic from the world when you can just like, oh, here are the facts, blah, 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 blah. So trying to find places with the Tree of Whispers to add a little bit more of that back into the world was the idea. But I do think Howarzar is in fact part of Sanctuary.
Awesome. Well, that's good to know. But I love the metaphor, though. I love the conversation, because like the way it spoke about in that section of the game is very much like,
who knows? Yeah, I don't know. Who knows?
Right? We don't know. And who knows what they? I mean, because with Diablo 4 being a live service game, I think the thing that's excited me the most is the ability for it to be a vessel for storytelling in Sanctuary, and that is like, you know, what I love the most about Diablo 4 is like, because like we've had little things in the first couple seasons with like side quests, but you know, once we get everything where, you know, people on the team and outside of the team, you know, fans are all happy with where the game is at from a end game standpoint, a loop standpoint, whatever you want to call it, then we can start seeing more of that story pipeline in through little side quests. And like, I'm so excited for Vessel of Hatred, because I mean, Mephisto is dad, right?
I worked on that one significantly. I put a lot of, I was the campaign person. I mean, it's all changed since I've left. I can't take any credit for any of this stuff, but I worked heavily on the campaign, and it was like some really, really good stuff, and I'm excited.
Oh, I'm excited. Yeah, excited.
Well, nice teaser for everybody there.
What we're talking about Howarzar and things that are not in Sanctuary, is it Ooray or Ura?
I've always pronounced it Ure, but I don't know. Okay. I don't think we have an internal pronunciation guide, but a lot of that stuff is like, unless it was pronounced by a character in a game somewhere, it's only ever been written.
Yeah.
Like Travancol has been pronounced in D2 by you know, Deckard in Act 3. He says Travancol. We have the record of how someone says it, so it's not Travinkle, it's Travancol or whatever, right, as an example. But I don't think Ure has ever been dead, so I don't think there's any like correct way to say it. I guess when voice recording goes in that says that word, it will be like, that's the way it's said, I guess. That's how it kind of happens sometimes. So that's, wait for that one, I guess, whenever that gets pronounced, and we'll all be surprised, I'm sure.
I have been waiting decades to go there. Like in a game, Diablo 3 teased me with it. They put it in the announcement cinematic in 2008. You know, it's like, oh shit, we're going there, and then we didn't. And then now I can stand outside the gates of the city, and I still can't get
You're
in.
So close.
Yeah, no, I know. We had a lot of conversations about Uray as like, it's there. Like, it's if you look at the map, it's right there, unless we want to push it a little further south across the river. But, like, it's probably there. But we were like, what is it? Like, how do we pay it off? And it's also, like, it's a big... The idea of Uray being, like, weirdly trapped in limbo, like, how do we do that with our engine? Like, how do we actually pull that off in a way that's satisfying? So we're like, do we hold on this? Do we figure out a way to do it? Like, there's tons of conversations about what Uray could be that I'm sure are still happening, like, now that I'm not there anymore, so I can't speak on that stuff. But, like, we knew Uray was there, and we couldn't just pretend it wasn't there. So what can we do to at least acknowledge, like, we know, we haven't forgotten, don't worry, we know Uray is supposed to be here, but there's just a lot of really important questions on how to present it to the players in a way that feels satisfying, right?
I mean, I've got a ton I could rattle off here, but I'm going to let you just take it here.
Whenever you want, Xanth, just please continue.
Yeah, just unleash, because, I could go forever. Right.
You guys are doing a great job on grabbing these smaller pieces. And I think, you guys are awesome. So in Diablo 2, Diablo 3, like the traditional quest pattern, you know, about six per act, right? And then we go to Diablo 4 and that gets blown out of the water.
Yeah.
How hard is it to manage the sheer amount of quests in this game? To make sure that they deliver, whereas any other iteration really just had to lock in six of them, and some of them kind of sucked in general too. But now you've got 200, and they're spread out over a massive world. How do you balance that?
Are you specifically calling out the campaign? The campaign quests?
No, I'm thinking more side quests. I mean, like, campaign quests, sure, absolutely. Like, they're integral, but they're easy to follow, right?
Mm-hmm.
The side quests that are built into every single zone are... Some are upfront, some are found.
Yeah, go find those things, yeah.
Right? I guess, how do you balance all the quests to compensate for the normal six that we would do?
Yeah, it's it was a challenge. It was a massive lift. We have a lot of, like, the quest team is just filled with extremely hardworking and talented people. Is the answer? It's just like, it's just legwork. It's just like hard work, like manual labor. We don't have any sort of like radiant randomization system. Like, every single quest is handmade. And every single line of dialogue is voiced. We don't have the luxury of, like, World of Warcraft, where they can just throw up, like, a text box and just, like, fill you in, right? So there was a budget that we had for, like, how many lines can you get per quest. So the process... So I'm happy to walk through the exact process that we used. As a zone supervisor, I have you know, insight into how we did this. So we'll use Howzard as an example. I work with the creative director. We sit down and be like, okay, what are the narrative themes we want for Howzar? What's the vibe, right? What's the vibe check for Howzar? And we'd say, like, okay, it's swamps and poison. We have the Tree of Whispers. We have, like, witches and occult, weird black magic there. We have these, like, snakes. These were mutated snake people. They're occultists that worship them. We have, like I said earlier, the Crusaders are here. We have, like, a sort of anti-religion sort of, like, push in one of the towns to the north. We just rattle off all the, like, things that made Howzar feel like Howzar, right? And then we would take those and break them up per subzone or region and say, okay, well, Zarbenzet is the main town, so that's where the Crusaders are going to be, so all the things in that subzone are going to be, like, Crusader requests, and they're going to be about the sad, broken soldiers of the Crusaders. Backwater was my attempt to do a sort of, like, barter town, sort of like criminal town, but it's like their own rules, like they kind of
cool,
like,
by the way, like, I like that portion was like its own campaign for me.
I'm glad
loved it.
I was really pleased with that name. I thought for a long time on that name, and I'm like, that seems like a name that a bunch of criminals would call a weird little town. Absolutely. That they built on the edge, like, Backwater, sure.
The origin of the scoundrel.
We knew that we knew I was like, well, I want, we need a big boss, we need, like, a big boss criminal to run the Bartertown, town, like, who's it going to be? And I was like, well, Lyndon is the makes the perfect sense. Let's bring him back, and we can see what he's been up to. And there was also Lyndon quests that never made it into D3 that I actually talked to developers who are on D3 that's still on the team. We're like, what was the plan for like future Lyndon content that you guys never got to do about the wife and the brother and the kids and stuff? And so we didn't make the quest about that, but we like allude to it here and there. So we, you know, like, okay, like we want to have the criminal town over here dealing with like their sailor friends that are coming back as drowned. Up in the north, we have the Tree of Whispers, and I wanted that to feel like the haunted forest with like the weird like laughter in the trees and like the weird creepy haunted forest. So we would start assigning the themes that we wanted to like areas, right? So we would take two or three teams per areas, or maybe like a theme for the town to kind of like anchor the town and what the town's all about, all the side quests in the town. And then we would do what we would actually scope the quest. So we would have, we'd say, okay, how long does it take to make a quest in Diablo? Let's say it takes a couple of weeks to do like a standard quest in Diablo. We have bigger quests, we call them major quests, we have standard quests, we have minor quests, which is like the short kind of popcorn quests, you know. How many do we think we can make in the time that we have before we ship Diablo 4? We come up with a number. So just for example, 2 major quests, 10 standard quests, or chains, standard quest chains, and like or 5 standard quests and then like 10 minor quests, right? And then we'd go down the list of the themes that we had, and we're like, okay, well, the Thaisa like emotional like trauma healing quest is major. It's a major quest because it uses a major character, and it's also like a big chain. It's like a beefy chain. We really want to give it the stuck, like the juice that it needs. The Krez stuff, the weird, like, you know, like Vine Man, we'll give him a couple of miners, we'll string them together into a cool quest. That's probably enough time to deal with like the one shot of like that guy's vibe. You don't need a ton of quests for him. Like Crusaders, we'll do some singleton quests to get the Crusaders vibe out. So we started like assigning the, like, how big is the narrative theme? How much room does it need to sort of like breathe and say, well, this feels like a big quest. It feels like a couple of small quests. And then we would sort of like dot them around the map and figure out where we wanted this to go. And then we'd assign them to the quest designers and be like, okay, like this quest is going to be about Lyndon's backstory. I don't know what that means. Like write a design document, hit these notes in the design document, and sort of like a really simple map of where the quests might take you, and like see if there's any cool POIs that the artists have already sort of like placed down. Is there an old like ruined chapel you can put the quest in or whatever? Maybe send it in that direction. If you need like a cellar or a dungeon or whatever, we can talk about like how many dungeons a quest might get or whatever. And then we just asked them to make it, and we just play it. And so we also had we used the program called Miro, which is like a shared whiteboard app online. And we had a big master map of like the entire game, and we had like arrows going from each like quest start to quest end in like Hauazar to be like, oh, like all the quests in this area are all going to this like one POI. Like that's, we got a traffic jam here. We got to like spread this out. Or like this corner down here has nothing. There's nothing in the fens. We got to put some quests in the fens. Maybe we'll move that snake quest down to the fens and do it down there instead. And then from there, we just kind of like let the designers own it, really, and we just play tested them together. So what we definitely didn't want was like every single quest starts in a town. We definitely wanted the, like, you find a person out in the field and they're looking for their mom's house, and so we just said like, hey, you know, it would be great if this quest started somewhere in the field, because we already have like 3 quests that start in Zarbenzet. And we would just check in with each other, right, to make sure that we weren't all making the same quests and all going to the same location. So that's kind of how it worked. And we would just have to do like quest team playtests together to make sure we were playing each other's content, giving each other feedback, and being like, oh man, you know, like, this quest has a similar beat to my quest. Maybe I should change my quest to make sure that it's not like another quest where somebody's cousin has gone missing and they're dead in a field somewhere. Cause we have a lot of those. How can we like make sure we're all hitting different beats and different notes? Or like, oh, this quest is like too many beats. We are talking to someone in a row. Like maybe throw in like a zombie ambush in the center to like give you some action here to make sure it's not just like one note. You have some high beats and some low beats. And or like, oh, you're trying to get a character to like tell me this really important story thing here, but I'm getting attacked by goatmen and I can't really pay attention to the story. Maybe build a quiet beat in here where you go to a safe place, you go back to town, so you can have a moment of like RP and some like theater that you can do safely before you go back out into the wilderness to kill demons and stuff again. So we would all just sort of like work on the quests together and keep in touch with each other as it all kind of came on board. And different quest designers would have like, you know, a couple of people worked on Fractured Peaks, a couple of people worked on Hauazar, et cetera, et cetera. And we didn't really mix the pots too much. Like sometimes you'd be like, I need to do something besides a snow quest. Please, can I do something in Kajistan? But for the most part, like we had people like dedicated to those zones. So, but to answer your question, a lot of work. Just a lot of work. Yeah, a lot of work.
Yeah. No, I think that's always super interesting to kind of get an idea of what's happening behind the scenes. Obviously my experience is only on the player side, right? I just get to play the finished product. I have no idea how the sausage is actually being made there.
It's also just really interesting going through and hearing that you're like trying to attach like quests and stuff like that, that like the artist team had already like kind of like put those points of interest, in the game itself, but just like random doodads and stuff, and you're like, I should put a quest
It's a
there. Is
leapfrog,
there,
right? So like we couldn't, the quest team is later in the pipeline a lot of times, or like it takes a long time to make a quest, and people we the and sort of the environment artists would be like, hey, like give us a list of POIs that you want. And sometimes we're like, okay, well obviously we want like this and this, like we know early on we're going to want a couple of things like this, but a lot of it's like we have empty spaces and like you guys are artists, like we trust you, make some dope stuff and like we'll use it. Just I need like an interior. I'd go into Zarmatep and be like, I need like two interiors requests. But ultimately, like we would leapfrog each other. So we'd have the campaign would be earlier. We'd know we need some POIs for the campaign, and then side quests would come in. It's like, oh, the Thaisa quest needs a dungeon entrance here or whatever. But other than that, it's like just you guys have to kind of continue doing your job in front of us sometimes. So we will have to come in later and just use what you guys have given us. Just kind of make sure that the combat spaces are okay, like they're big enough for combat. Hey, there's some ruins here, some old Crusader ruins. Well, we'll definitely use those. We will want to send people to them. I often say that there's two big things that side quests are intended to do in Diablo 4. One of them is to send you to interesting POIs. That are important, like world, like the Statue of Tybalt, right? Like the big headless statue, which we knew we wanted. We want like a crusader, a failed crusader, like an example of a failed crusader monument, and like that went in really early. We're like, well, we want players to see that. You might never notice it otherwise. So we want to send you there specifically. And the other thing is to, like, as I said earlier, like really expand on existing world building beats, more about like the factions and the characters and stuff. So if there's art that really sells, like, oh, this is all about the drowned, like weird head statues that are like buried in the ground coming up out of the ground, or oh, this is like a old graveyard and all the water table's so high that the graves are popping out of the ground and stuff, like we want to really bring people to those locations. So it's absolutely kind of like a symbiotic relationship.
All right, I got my question in. Now you guys go.
I mean, I have I mean, Nine, you might have the questions I have to answer. I don't think you're going to be able to answer, even if
Well,
you know the
what?
answer. I
Let's
don't.
see. Let's try it.
All right, fine. So, Hawazar, you have to have gotten this question before. So we're in Hawazar, right? There's the witches, right, which feel oddly adjacent to witch doctors, and then also swamp. But obviously, we've kind of confirmed that that's not really where the witch doctors come from. We know where they come from. But it felt very witch doctor adjacent. But then on top of that too, you have the big elephant in the room, or the big snake in the room. Tragul exists, right?
Yep.
Tragul exists, is giant balance snake.
Does
I mean,
he?
dragon, obviously, but
Does he? Who knows?
well,
Who knows?
I've gotten that answer before from previous like creative leads
Yeah.
and such.
And that's why I'm saying is like you're talking about being vague intentionally, so it kind of leaves room for them to like kind of tell the story they want to tell when they get to that point. So that's what I'm saying, like my questions are probably all going to fall in that category of like they were intentionally vague, but that felt like at least Tragul adjacent, similar to the witches and witch doctor
Yeah.
adjacents. So.
The witches and the witch doctors are totally not related at all. Not even close. They're 100% the witch, there being witches was a thing the creative director was like, day one, Hauazar, I want witches here. Like classic medieval fantasy witches, that's what we want. But we want them to be neutral. They're like morally gray. They have their own thing going on. They're not witch doctors at all. They work for the tree. And that's when I did the heretic quest line. It was about, I put a lot of like personal emotional stuff into that, about like escaping from an abusive relationship. But it was also to teach you how like witch culture works, which is like you don't get to choose. If the tree's like that person, you're going, you're a witch. There's no conversation. And they have like an agenda, and they kind of like keep the swamp safe for the tree, right? So very different, like the witch doctor stuff from what's the area called?
Umbaro.
The grasslands.
Umbaro.
Thank you, God. Yeah. Woo, the Umbara. Very different cultures, not related. But maybe at some point someone's like, oh, you know, maybe they like there was some cross pollination, like cultural. Maybe they talk to each other, whatever. But right. But when we built the witches, it was 100% like, no, these are Hauser witches. But I actually tried very hard when we made the so we made Gulius and Zerk. And they come from different places. Like Gulius is very pale, right? She's probably from the Fractured Peaks somewhere. I wanted Zerk to be sort of like olive skinned, and I think I mentioned that he was like a homeless kid in Kedistan at some point. Where he was like a cut purse like kid, like a you know. And then like he was called, and this is his life now. So they come from all over the world. It's not just Hauser, but they now have been brought here.
Right.
So it's a very, very different culture. But for the snake stuff, it's funny because there was earlier dialogue where I think like Lareth said something like, oh, I'm going to follow Rathmus Snake. And I'm like, you cannot say Rathmus Snake because people are going to immediately be like, that's Tregul.
Right. Yeah. We said that anyway.
It's supposed to be like the snake that Rathma saw or Rathma followed or whatever. It was that like that's the snake of Rathma, but it's not supposed to be like Rathma's snake. And so like I tried to change it, but I think like it was just too late in the process.
You stare into the scales and you see like potential timelines.
You see weird shit. Yeah, yeah, like yeah. That,
which is also another trait.
It's a multiversal snake now, right?
Yeah. So we. First off, there's no dragons in Diablo until there are, until some like shop armor says that there's dragons in Diablo. And you're like, I guess there's dragons in Diablo. But like, clearly early days, people would be like pitching stuff. And you're like, there's no dragons in Diablo. Like there's never been dragons in Diablo other than, you know, Tathamet, which is not really in Diablo. But like in like the actual, like in Sanctuary, there aren't dragons. It's not like that kind of fantasy game. Yeah. So the idea of like time dragon, to me personally, again, just speaking as Harrison, like, and it was always like really weirdly antithetical to like the grounded weird medieval horror darkness of Diablo, of like, oh, there's actually a secret good guy out there watching us and making sure it all goes to plan. Just felt weird. Like all the Anu Tathamet stuff is really fun world building, but it's just like mm-hmm. it's a fun fact to learn, but I can't emotionally connect to like Anu. Like it's like God. Like how do you connect to, like, so whenever they're like, oh yes, there's a secret dragon out there watching the timelines and stuff, it felt very World of Warcraft in a way that just felt different than like the tone that Diablo was trying to hit. So my own headcanon, or a couple of people on the team's headcanon, was that maybe like Tregul was like Rathma's like other personality, and he was like almost like talking to himself, like he needed a smart person to like bounce ideas off of, and he like fucking like manifested a crazy like star dragon to talk to. That is not supported in any way by Blizzard, but it's the way that I imagine it was like, we sunset like Tregul because no one can pronounce his name, no one gets his name right. We always like had this argument about how it's pronounced because old games and the spelling errors. Oh god, what if we just like sunset Tregul? That did not happen, but I've always felt like that those like really high level like astrological like world building and ending stuff is like, it's fun to read in the back of a manual, but like it's not a story you can really attach emotion to. So generally want to push away from like the god beings, because then you ask questions like, why aren't they helping out, you know? Like I actually remember writing dialogue in the By 3 Day Come quest when one of the Rathma buddies shows up and like harasses Elias. And he's like, you can't, don't mess with the balance, man. And Elias is like, where's your boy been at all these times that the gods, like the Diablo's shown up and like wrecked house, and he's just sat there watching it happen? Like, maybe your guy sucks, actually. I think they revved that out of the dialogue, but that was the intent behind that scene where Elias is like, no, Rathma hasn't done anything to help humans, so I'm gonna do it, actually. And you're like, he's not wrong. So trying to bring it back to like the people has always been the goal of at least for Diablo 4's like core story.
Makes sense. Which brings me to my next question that you probably can't answer due to vagueness, but Tyrael.
Yeah, what about him? Good question.
I mean, like, okay, like good we question. Know it's very vague what happens, and there's different kind of takes on how it happens, but obviously Tyrael has been such a huge part of the lore and the your player character's lore throughout all of the games.
Yep.
I like the idea to steer away from Tyrael because it felt very different and apart from what he's done. And while I love Tyrael, I think we all got tired of human Tyrael in town just talking about how he'd eaten too much for like 10 years in Diablo 3, which honestly kind of sucks because it made him a meme a little bit when, you know, it's Tyrael, dude. It's fucking Tyrael. Like, it shouldn't be a meme. But at the same time, right? Like, Is it the same kind of principle that you applied to Tyrio? I mean, obviously, I wasn't really involved in the side quest part of it as much, but do you have any insight there?
I obviously can't say what the plans for all the characters that we haven't talked about in the game yet. I can't speak to that. But what I can say is we really actively try to avoid the temptation of just like throwing all the action figures in a box and be like, yeah, action figure, like everything's here. All your favorites are here, baby.
That's a great way to bring that. That makes sense.
So like, it's like what you instinctively want as a fan and what's good for a story is not always the same thing.
Yeah.
And a lot of people early on were like, I just want to get on a motorcycle with Kirill and kick some demons in the balls and just shoot guns in the air. And you're like, yeah, but that's not the story that we want to tell in this specific game.
Buy that game.
I would totally buy that game.
Sure. Yeah. You might have to make it yourself. We have to make the best choice for this specific game. We have to make the best choice for Diablo 4. Not worrying about future games, not worrying about the past games. Like, we have to make the calls that make this game as strong as it can be. And the creative director had a very specific story that he wanted to tell. And this comes up with the Nephilim too. And I don't know if that question's come out. I'll answer it too. Yeah. Like, once again, like, the Nephilim suck all the air out of the room. Like, how can you have a story where the Nephilim just show up as bit players? They're like gods. Yeah. Like, how do you, you know, they would just steal the spotlight immediately. It doesn't mean we've forgotten about them. It doesn't mean we don't talk about them. We're not intentionally like cutting them out because we don't want to use them, or they're not important, but like, there was a very specific story that we wanted to tell about the human beings of Sanctuary, and we just didn't have room for characters that were so powerful or so like lore important to like, why would you listen to Lorath talk at all if Tyrael's also there?
Right. No, that's a very good point. That is a very good point.
And also, Tyrael has like prescient information where he would just tell you all this lore about like stuff when you needed to like go into like tombs and stuff and find it. And it was intentional that Lorath felt very different from Deckard Cain, because Deckard Cain's like book guy, and he has all the book lore, and he's all in his head, and Lorath is like out there like beating the pavement and like making connections with people and talking to thieves and like greasing palms and like that. He's a very different kind of Haradrim. Mm-hmm. And so we just felt like, you know, Tyrael came up a lot, and there were definitely versions of the story that had him in there, and it just felt like we're just doing this because.
Yeah,
he's Tyrael.
Like, you had to.
He doesn't actually fit in the story. Sense. He just feels like we have to have him. And it honestly felt like doing him a disservice. So again, I can't speak to the future, but the team knows, we all know that those characters are still out there. For the very specific story that shipped in D4, we just couldn't fit them and then really do them justice.
And just like I said, right? He's not going to be able to answer these questions. I do appreciate the insight, though. The insight's almost
just like
as valuable.
It's like an okay answer. I can't answer.
It's a great answer.
It's not an answer.
But, you know.
It's one of those things that, like, people need to actually go through, like, and acknowledge. You know, it's something that comes up, like, all the time in, like, superhero and comic stuff. It's like, who will beat who and such. And
right,
like,
yeah.
People have to accept that the answer is whatever the story dictates.
It's correct, you know? Yeah,
it's like,
right.
That's really what it comes down to. It's like, it's what's the lore answer? The lore answer is vague because the story dictated that it was better off for him not to be there. That's what it is.
Yeah, and honestly, like, a lot of times you don't want to do the thing that's like lore cute. Like, we could have packed this game full of little winks, and like the lore nerds like us would have been like, yeah, you guys get it, but like, is that a story? It just feels like it's just a box of references. You know, we didn't want to just
member berries.
Yeah, we just wouldn't. We didn't want to do a box of references. We wanted the story to stand on its own. If you've never played a Diablo game before, we really wanted to capture a new audience with this game, right? So if you come in and it's all like, let me tell you all about Tyrael and stuff, you'd be like, what is happening? So like, if in the prologue, right? Like, there is a sequence when we introduce an Ares at the statue. It's all broken, right? Mm-hmm. And we have to be like, hey, if you don't know anything about the Eternal Conflict, here is your like 3-sentence primer of what the Eternal Conflict is, because you're going to hear it a lot. You actually do need to know what this is. And so like, coming in on the 4th iteration of a game and being like, there's a crap load of lore you have to know, it's really off-putting for a new player. So trying to find a way to like onboard them in just the stuff they need to know, just so you have the context of like what's going on in the world, while not like dumping, dumping the bucket of proper nouns over people's heads. Like, immediately you have to know like all these people's names, like the duchy of this 20,000 years ago, they did this, and this character did this, and used this magic spell to make this thing happen. And you're like, your eyes just like glaze over, and you're like, I don't know what is happening. So really making sure that we like drip fed hey, here's who Lilith is. Here's what she, why she matters and what she's all about. Here's who Inarius is and what the Eternal Conflict is all about. Like, that's why it doesn't start. The opening crawl has like nothing to do with any of that stuff, right? Yeah. So it's tough to tell a story where you, there's like all this lore that you have to deal with, but you can't really be shackled by it. Otherwise, you're just going to keep drawing the same box over and over again. And people are going to be like, just Diablo 4 just felt like Diablo 3, which felt like Diablo 2. Like, you want to break new ground. That's why, like, we introduced new characters like Donin, Nayrel, because it could have been easy to have no new characters and just be all familiar faces, and then you'd be like, why did I spend money on this game? It's just the same story again, you know?
No, that's awesome, and I think you know the team did a really good job with that. Like, again, I still, you know, Diablo 4 is the most robust and engaging story, I think, that of any Diablo game. And I love Diablo 1 and Diablo 2, but those stories were really just text in a box that you could just skip if you wanted to and just move on. You know, a lot of it came in the books that we read, you know, that was really it. And that's where you got that deep dive lore. So that's what turned me from, you know, normal Diablo player to, like, you know, forever nerd. But the last one, and this is the last question, and I've got to ask you this because you're like the closest thing to an authority figure on the matter, even though you probably have zero to do with this at all. Harrison, am I a vampire?
Oh, I don't know. Are you? You tell me.
That's it. Yeah.
So okay. I will. Again, once again, I will give you my Harrison personal opinion on seasonal stuff. I personally, again, not a representative of Blizzard here. I personally believe that, and I would fight in meetings about seasonal stories should be bottles. They should just be a bottle. Like, when the season ends, those characters go away. It doesn't mean they're not canon, but because they go away, you can sort of mentally distance it from, like, the rest of the game. We're like, yeah, like, Varshawn is real, and all the stuff he did with his buddy, like, happened, right? Like, that stuff doesn't just delete. But, like, it's not quite canon. It's, like, not canon, but it's canon, right? Because it ends. And there were a lot of discussions about, like, bringing back other characters. And you know what? Maybe that'll still happen. But, like, at the time, there's a lot of discussions about bringing back seasonal characters to be, like, in the Eternal Realm eventually. And I personally was like, I don't really want to see them. A, because if I didn't do the season, I won't know who the heck they are.
Right.
Yeah, and we don't want to have, like, the entire intent behind seasons is, like, you don't have to do them all. If you want to take a break, that's okay. You don't miss any of, like, the really important ongoing story. And if we start to break down those barriers a little bit, it starts to get a little bit of that FOMO. So I was like, I really don't want to see what's his name, Cormund, in, you know, in Fractured Peaks couple of weeks from now, a couple of months from now, talking about, like, yeah, thanks, remember that time we did that fun thing together? Because it starts to break down the boundary between the season and the base game
and the lore.
And I do believe that, and like I said, it's absolutely canon. Like, it absolutely, that stuff happened, but there's, like, suspension of disbelief that you can be like, well, it ended, the season went away, so maybe it's not quite canon. There's kind of a mental reset that you do, like an emotional and mental reset you do, where, like, you kind of just, like, let that stuff go as a thing that happened in a weird little vacuum, like a weird little, like side dimension. And it's also, like, the idea of the Jenga Tower, of, like, all the bosses that are, like, all the threats that show up after, like, 12 seasons or whatever, of, like, oh, there's just infinite other horrible monsters out there. Like, forget Lilith. There's, like, 12 other things that are trying to kill us. And, like, trying to remember all of them and why they were all doing their thing. Like, the idea of the reset, where you're like, cool, like, Zier's done. We don't worry about Zier coming back and being a thing other than a boss ladder guy. That's, like, I can emotionally sort of, like let that go and free that space in my brain for the next season, is actually what I would argue is actually really important. Do other people on the team agree? I don't know. But right. I think that to answer your question, like, I personally would be like, no, that would happen in, like, a weird pocket dimension. But I couldn't answer that with any sort of authority.
Awesome. And I want to apologize for everyone for the last 15 minutes. What I told you, he would not be able to answer. But your insight was really, really valuable and really cool, Harrison. I mean, like,
I honestly was expecting it when you said, like, your very first question, that you were going to ask him if you were a vampire.
I've been wondering that for months. Like, am I, like, because, you know, I was a vampire, and I leveled up as a vampire, and then I just wasn't anymore. And now
you got the Durban rings now, so, you know.
I've got vampire boots. Yeah,
it's true. I think that, at least I hope it gives some insight into how sticky development
of
video games is. And it's not a thing that we go into lightly. You know, like, there's a lot of thought that goes into these kinds of decisions.
Yeah. That's my thought too, right? Like, if in my head canon, it goes in one ear out the other. But then, like Zier specifically, that's a really cool origin for a character, especially how that ties into the first ones and all that stuff, and or the Nephilim, whatever the hell we're calling them now. But it's really interesting. So, like, yeah, I don't know. It's just wild. And very excited to see where, you know, all that stuff goes, because again, while I know we are the minority and there's a bunch of people out there rolling their eyes because we're not talking about endgame systems and loot, whatever. There's at least a few on this podcast. And I love the story of Diablo. It's what gripped me. Like, the gameplay loop can be mimicked and imitated by any other game, and that's fantastic. But I play Diablo because I've always loved the lore and the story of Diablo and the world that's created there. So thank you for answering those.
Yeah, of course.
No, I'm going to jump in here. Yeah, Nemo, let me take a pause, bud. Just because there's a nice little segue here. So Diablo 4 came to Game Pass a few weeks ago, right? Mm-hmm. And it became one of the more popular. I think it's now the most popular vehicle for people to play Diablo. Hey,
nice.
Awesome. Makes sense, right? The version of Diablo 4 now, when you launch it, you have the ability to skip the campaign from the first get-go. Mm-hmm. Which means you lose out on a lot of that. A lot of kind of what we've all talked about here today. It does, I believe, to skip it, I think you still, to skip and make a seasonal, I think you still have to go through the prologue, right?
Yeah.
Thoughts on the skip campaign?
Yeah, I mean, it breaks my heart, but it's like, it's a video game. Ultimately, at the end of the day, what's really important for all game developers, I think, like globally, is to generally respect the way that people want to play. And if you don't want to engage with the story, I don't want to force you to, because you're not going to enjoy it. You're not going to have a good time. If you want to just like kick demons in the balls, like that's why you bought Diablo 4. Especially if you're like your buddy told you pick the game up and we can like go kill some demons together, and you got to go through a story that you're not really engaged with. I would prefer you just play the game the way you want to play it and enjoy the experience, and then maybe later you try it. And maybe you like it. It's really important to not like grab people's like head and like wrench them. Like the fun's over here. I promise you. Like the thing. I think this is fun, and I made it to be fun. So you better freaking enjoy it. Because even if you were the kind of person who enjoyed that experience, you just hate it immediately when you're told to do it. Mm-hmm. So this is one of those like pieces of tension as a game developer, especially a narratively focused game developer, is I care deeply about a lot of stuff that a lot of other people don't. And it's really important to understand my place in the hierarchy of the video game product as a game. And like, I know that side quests aren't the most important part of the game to most people. I know that. I fully accept that's not the thing that a lot of players come to. You take some soul searching to get there. And what makes it easier is knowing that there are tons of people out there that care so deeply about that stuff. And it's for like, that's who I'm really doing it for, right? But I also want to give people an opportunity to find out that they actually do love that stuff. So maybe a person who is just a grinder pops a quest one time. And they're like, oh, you know what? This is really interesting. I'd like to like learn more about this. And then you sort of like engage on your own terms with content that you might not otherwise dip toe into. So I understand completely why they added it. It does break my heart a little bit, but I also respect that like the game's been out for X months. Most of the people that were going to play the campaign have probably already played the campaign, and the seasonal way to play is kind of the like expected way to play. Like, we kind of want you to play seasonal, right? So it is. And you know, when I play seasonal, obviously I skip the campaign too, because I've done it. I played the campaign. So if you play the campaign, I wouldn't want you to do it over and over again. So you're absolutely right, and it's a shame, but there's just a ton of people who don't prefer to play the game a certain way. That is not my way to play the game, and I want to respect that. And I think it's important to respect the player's time. They bought the product, they bought the game, they spent their money on it. They should be able to have the fun that they want to have with it.
Was there any talk, like, because we've had the ability to skip the campaign, you know, for a while, but you had to get through it first to actually do it. Was there any talk of that not being an option with like almost every other ARPG on the market now? You still have to engage with the campaign to get going. And in some ways, like in the absence of it, I've kind of wanted to go back to that. I don't know. It feels wrong not having that arrow to move you.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah. I honestly, no, I agree. I mean, like, it's my preferred way to level from 1 to 50, no question. But I think that There was, I don't think there was, and a lot of these discussions did not happen with me in the room. But I, from my understanding, it was, we were always going to have a skip campaign button because of the seasonal content. Because it's a short period of time, you only have a couple of months to get through seasonal content. And if people like flame out trying to do the campaign, and just being like, I've done the campaign already, I don't want to do it again. And they eject before they've even hit, because you have to do the campaign before you can do the seasonal stuff. Like, you have to have it done. So if you want people to try the new fun stuff, or they're coming back and they haven't played for 6 months or whatever, you want to play season four, season five, and they really want to see what's new, if we force them to do the campaign, it's like, I've already done all this, I want to see the new stuff. And it just sours that experience before they even get to it. So I again, I can't speak with a ton of authority on this, but I think it was always the case that we were going to let people skip the campaign eventually, once you've done it once, because there's the seasonal content that we really want to get you to engage with.
Totally logical, totally fair, and totally nine balls question.
Yeah, I wish that I could have filled this one in when we were still like talking about Halazar. I just couldn't find like the proper segue in and stuff like that. But like the one last like burning question that I have is as a necromancer main, you know, since Diablo 2, is Rathma's temple and Halazar like the sunken city, or is the sunken city located somewhere in Halazar?
The sunken city is
kind of like the home base of the necromancer, or the priests of Rathma.
Are you talking about the necropolis?
Yeah. It was always referred to as just like the necromancers operate out of the sunken city, and it was always referred to be like in the jungles and the swamps,
right?
East of Khajistan.
Right.
So it's like kind of like felt as if like it should be like in Halazar type area.
Right. Right. I hear you. So it is not the necromancer headquarters. It was always like a Rathma themed place. And I think there's like necromancer themed banners and stuff floating in the water there. The idea there was, I think the lore I came up with for that was that it was where potential death speakers would go. That's why I think it's called like Temple of the Death Speaker. To like do like a final trial to be like, are you worthy to be like the next death speaker? And I think I put that lore on a unique audit. Like, this again, like, you sneak lore in whenever you can find space for it. Like, I didn't have space to tell the story of the Temple of the Death Speaker, so I just like use the unique item to like seed that sneak that information out. So it's not supposed to be their headquarters. I think it's a place where like Rathma long ago was like his sort of like his little fort, like Rathma's like private zone, mom keep out. And then I think at some point he stopped using it, and it became repurposed as this sort of like trial zone for potential death speakers to sort of like see if they're worthy and strong enough to like inherit that mantle. And then they would return to the necropolis, to like the headquarters of the necromancers. So that wasn't at all intended to make it sort of seem like that should be the, where all like the necromancers hang out. But it's supposed to be sort of like a branch office.
Gotcha. Yeah. Will we go there one day? I know you don't work there anymore, but yeah.
Who knows? Yeah. Who's to say?
He's like, yes, definitively.
Maybe there's fun stuff hiding in the jungles.
No, there's not. There's flayers and fucking mosquitoes. They're not.
That's
fun.
True. Yeah,
they
that's
murder
true.
Me.
Yeah. It's just the wasp shoots fun. The little wasp. It's the only monster in all of that area.
Now we need a wasp that shoots undead flayers.
Yeah, okay. That's Digidoll specifically. So they do damage, and then when they explode, they do even more ridiculous
damage. Oh, yep.
Lord.
That's bugged and has never been
good
fixed.
Good task.
And we can just throw Iron Maiden back in, too, and just make it completely busted. Maybe a good sign.
Oblivion Knight just appears out of nowhere. Guess what you need?
I remember, I think there was an early day where I had a unique item. I called like the Oblivion Knight sword or something like that, because I was like, oh, that's a cool. I think it was. I changed it to something else that was more appropriate to like the story that we were trying to tell at that point. But I remember
obviously
for a
less
hot
cool,
minute.
Though.
Well, I don't disagree, but it was. I think I called it like Oblivion Knight's blade or something like that, because I was like, oh, that's a memorable enemy from early Diablo. I tried to do as much of that with the uniques as I did. I basically stole unique item naming from like people. They're like, hey, can I name all the uniques, because I love naming stuff and writing flavor text, and they're like, we don't have any time for any of the writers to do it, so fine, do whatever, just go, man, just stop bothering us, please. And I would, every day I'd be like, please, can I like my nose against the glass, like, can I do unique items? So I luckily got to like name all the unique items and flavor them up through season 3, because I just like nagged them enough to do it. And so that's where I snuck in all my like references to Mendel and references to like Juritz the Mighty and stuff like that. So the characters that we've like mentioned but never like knew anything about, it was like you trying to use the unique items to like fill in the empty spaces of the world's lore.
Just so you know, the first time the Ring of Mendel dropped in a game for me, I ran into the next room to yell at my girlfriend and my son, "Oh my god, you should be
yeah!"
And they were like, "What are you talking about?
I'm what like, is wrong mind, with you? Are you mind, crazy? Yeah, yeah.
Right. Well, actually, so I have a really hard-hitting journalistic question for you then. Shaco or Shaco?
Oh god. Oh. I don't, it's another one of those things where like it was never like spoken except by the fans or whatever. So I think
Shaco
it's,
to me forever.
Is it Shaco?
And
that's what it is, man. That's it's Shaco.
I appreciate the validation.
It's not a leather cap. It's like a totally different shape. If you look at what those actually are, they're completely different. Back in the day, I mean, they just picked any word that meant hat. We had that problem with D4 too, where you're like, how many times can I use the word greaves? Like I've used tassets. I don't know tassets now. I like trying to look up new words for like armor, and you're like, I got nothing. I'm out of ideas for this. So we'll just call them slippers. So trying to find words that like mean hat, boy, they really pulled a deep cut with that one.
Well, I think as we're getting close to the end here, and we are prolonging your dinner
a little bit.
It's totally fine. I'm having a great time.
No, this is awesome. But we don't want to keep you too long. Last questions. Anything left on your plate, gentlemen, that you have not asked Harrison?
I've talked a lot. Nine, you got something?
Yeah. No.
Okay. Well, then I got one. And this is
a lot of the questions I actually came in with were more like technical questions about like the field and such, which just have been answered.
Yeah.
You know, throughout the flow of the conversation and such. So.
Yeah. No. Well, then I'll ask one. You know, you spend a lot of time on the side quests and stuff, and like I said, I really appreciate the discussion about like intentionality, like you're talking about. That means a lot to me and my work and what I do too. And so, I guess like with that in mind, like, do you have a favorite side quest that you designed, or that maybe someone else designed, or maybe like a favorite couple if you can't pick one? But
yeah,
I'm gonna jot them down because I can go redo them real quick and just check them out. But I'm curious.
Yeah, that's. I mean, like. Gosh, I have the Heretic is definitely the most like close to home one. That was like the like very personal story for me, and I was also really happy with like using the mechanics to tell the story. For example, like in the first quest, you like pick flowers for this girl, and she's like all timid and stuff, and then in the third quest, she's like ripping livers out of like dead corpses. Yeah. And like it's supposed to mirror the first. It's like the same thing. Get three things, and she's like, "I'll do it. I can do it." And she's like putting her wrist into like corpses and ripping livers out and stuff. And it was just to show the growth that she had gone through, right? So that kind of like escaping from an abusive relationship while also trying to tell stories about like the witches and stuff, as I said earlier, is very personal to me. I'm really proud. I'm really pleased with the reaction to the Sister Octavia questline that I did. The Exorcism quest. That was one that I'd done in a earlier version of the game, and I told, man, I was really like sad to see that quest go into the garbage can. I was really proud of it, and I pitched it to the zone supervisor of Fractured Peaks, and they were like, well, yeah, we're gonna put that back in. So I like snuck time to the side to make that quest happen. And then the animators gave me that great like coming like rising off the bed animation. Like they killed it. Like I was like, oh, I just need something to like make the kid look like he's floating. And they're like, what if we gave you a custom animation for the side quest? And I was like, incredible. Awesome. And people really like Sister Octavia. And again, like that quest was intended not just to be like a random exorcism quest, but it was like, hey, there are actually good people in the Cathedral of Light doing the best that they can under like a shitty kind of bureaucracy that doesn't care about them and will burn them at the stake in a heartbeat. But they're trying to do good works, and they really do believe, they are true believers in the method, like the message of the church. So I'm really happy. People seem to really like that one. I'm really, really happy about that one. The Thaisa quest was another one that I had originally given to other people.
She's one of the coolest characters in D4, by the way.
She's so cool. I love her.
The way she fleshed out honestly shocked me. Because I expected her to be like a one-off, like something happens and then you just never think about her again. But the fact that she came back and like that whole, that was a really cool twist.
Thank you so much. Yeah, so when we were talking about like major quest lines that we'd want to revisit, I immediately was like, well, I mean, like Thaisa went through a horribly traumatic, like, to be tattooed against your will is a very clear metaphor, right? And it was like, we can't just like, bad things happen in Diablo all the time, and then people just like dust themselves off and never talk about it again. And it's like, that's not how human beings react to trauma. Like, she went through something really serious, and I think it's really important for us as storytellers to like address that and not just be like, well, it's just video games, who cares? Like, that really happened to a person, and it's really messed up. And if you've ever been through a traumatic incident, like, all of that line, again, like, was very similar to like my own experiences, like working through things that I'm sure we've all worked through, of like, you just keep thinking it's going to happen again. Like, you just like, every day you're like, oh my God, it's happening again. How do you escape that cycle of just like spinning yourself up? And so originally I passed that quest off to other quest designers, because I have other quests to do, and I felt there were other designers more appropriate for telling that story. And just unfortunately with scheduling and sort of like staffing and stuff, it kind of fell back on my plate. So I did like close it out. I didn't finish the whole thing, but I like closed that quest out with the amulet, you know, with the mm-hmm. inscription on the bottom and stuff. And it was just, that was again like a very personal story that I thought was really important to, especially one of our only like women of color characters, to not just be like flippant about a horrible traumatic event that happened to them, and like really unpack what we're not really talking about other characters and all the NPCs that you help like are going through, but you can imagine now that they're all going through similar things.
Yeah.
Because we sort of like put that on the table of like, yeah, it's trauma and you don't just walk away from it. And then obviously the by 3 day conquest, like that was my, the moment I was the zone supervisor of Tower Czar, I put my thumb on the scale. I'm like, we're going to that dungeon. Like, I don't care what it takes. Yeah. Day one, this was like years ago. I was like, I want to find a spot. And I looked at the cinematic, and it's like, I'm kind of like a flat marsh and there's like mountains behind it. So I'm like, well, it kind of makes sense to be in Tower Czar, but all the northern borders already taken up stuff. So where can we find a spot for it? And all the artists and like dungeon designers were so excited. When I told them we were going to do that dungeon, they were like the engine started and everybody's like, let's get the literal like 3D models from the actual cinematic, and they like took those into the game and like simplified them down. Like, those are the actual assets from the cinematic, like simplified down. And I just love going to places in cinematics and video games. Like, that's my favorite thing ever. So I was just like, I want to go there, it's cool. And I had a massive team of incredibly talented people, artists, designers, sound people, to like crank that out and make that like really, really memorable. So those are the ones that I'm really the proudest of, for sure.
That's awesome. And yeah, that was an amazing find. Like, just derping around, right? Like, preseason, season one hasn't started yet, just going and doing every little quest. And then I went through my hardcore character and did all the little side quests again, just so I could get another round of them, right? And like, I remember I hadn't done that on my main character, because at the beginning of the game, there were some, like, you have the X out of X or whatever, and there was like some quests you couldn't get to, or like it was displaying wrong.
Yeah, you have to have finished the campaign beforehand, because you can't, because Elias has to be dead before you can like, change it. So you have to have finished the campaign first, yeah.
But yeah, when I finally came across that, though, it was like, whoa, wait a minute,
and pulled through. Yeah, that dawning moment of like, wait a second, I know this place.
This
looks
familiar. It's like
the chapel, it's like the exact chapel.
You see the blood on the ground.
The artist killed it. Yeah,
super cool. And that, and again, and I think that like it's a testament to the team, like you and the team and what you guys, you know, the care you put in it. There's so many moments like that in Diablo 4 that didn't exist in Diablo 3 or Diablo 2 or Diablo 1. Like, a lot of that lore stuff we went and found in books and comic books and other things, finding that in a Diablo game is the fucking coolest thing. So thank you.
I'm really glad. No, that means a lot, because we care so deeply, and the team cares so deeply, and whenever they can find a moment to pull out something that they really resonated with in a past Diablo game and like make the quest about that, knowing that someone else probably also resonated with it as well. It's like so important, and it's tough, because like we don't, other than like meeting in person, we don't get a chance to hear that stuff very often, right? Like on the internet or social media, you don't hear that stuff. So every so often people will go on Reddit and be like, look for like people talking about side quests and stuff, which is few and far between, but sometimes you see some people like, hey, what's your favorite quest? And you can be like, oh, that thing I worked on. So it's just really rare to actually get to hear that it matters to people. So I'm really appreciative, and I know the team is really appreciative, and they care so much about Diablo, and they care so much about the story and really making you feel like you're a part of it. It's one of the things that just drives the quest team. Like, the quest team is just filled with incredibly talented, passionate storytellers, and all they want to do is do more like lore stuff and like expand on the lore and introduce new lore and give people that love that stuff a place to really like find the home, you know.
Awesome.
Wow. As I said before, we've taken up a lot of your time.
It's not worth that much.
I sincerely doubt that. we'll still do post-show conversation. That's just for all of us. But we'll close it out as we always do with a homage to the cow level, which you can talk about.
What is a cow level?
It's okay, fine.
What is that? It sounds weird.
I had to do it at least. So we'll close it out as we always do with a moo, moo, moo.
Moo, moo, moo.
Moo, 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 moo.
Moo, 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 moo.